Missed the first semester, you're perfectly fine. Church history has a ginormous break at the Protestant Reformation, which is where we are, where we pick up this semester. Garrett, you already announced books to everybody. If you didn't get a book and you'd like one, we have some. Some of you got volume one from last year. If you didn't and would like one, they're available Amazon. I think it's, is it an ebook form? Can you get it? Kindle or ebook? Yeah. So, but church history from, you know, really the first 1,500 years of church history is dominated by the Catholic Church. And then when the Catholic Church and Orthodox Church split, those two entities, it's fairly simple. It's kind of a straightforward track. And as you all know, when we hit 1,500 and the Protestant Reformation, all of a sudden it just splinters. It fractures in all kinds of different directions. I've in a lot of conversations, I've talked with people about how interesting to me is the parallel that the Islamic religion is taking to the Christian religion about 500 or 600 years behind us. Because forever, and in lots of ways, but if you just think about that connection, and for most of our lifetime, followers of Islam are one of two branches. They are predominantly either Sunni or Shiite. And in today, I mean, today we are watching a version of Reformation taking place in the Islamic churches. You see your more extreme versions, and as the extreme versions are practicing their tendencies, you have the other versions of Islam that are kind of reforming and moving away, forming different trajectories of Islamic faith. I don't really know what that means. It's just an observation, but I suspect that 100 years from now, 200 years from now, you won't see just two versions of Islam. You'll probably see tens or hundreds of versions of Islam, kind of the same way you see multiple traditions of Christianity practiced today. So Protestant Reformation, it's, you know, around 1500. We even kind of saw some of the precursors of unrest at the end of last semester. The papacy had become growing more and more corrupt through the years. The connection of church and state allowed for the church to be commandeered by kings or emperors or leaders, and then all of a sudden religion didn't really matter. What mattered is our political agenda and how we can use religion to serve that end. The church continued to advocate for celibacy on the part of priests, even though lots and lots of bishops and popes would marry and have kids. They, for the longest time during the Crusades, the church had a constant stream of income coming in. Folks would go off to war, and they would be asked or forced, depending on the circumstance, to leave any property or possessions they have to the church in the event that they died in a far-off country in the middle of a holy war. And lo and behold, lots of people did and left the church lots and lots of inheritances, a constant stream of income. As we get closer to 1500, not as many crusades being fought, not as many wars being fought. The church doesn't have this constant stream of money coming in, and yet they'd already established this paradigm of large, ornate, you know, expensive buildings, and with much of their leadership, large, ornate, and expensive lifestyles that they had to keep up. And so, if we're not getting money from wars, what are we going to do? We can't really tax people. And so they start selling indulgences, selling favors, selling offices for the right price. I don't know if you could be pope. You might could be pope. I don't know that there's any case of people buying their way into the papacy. There, Garrett says there is. Bishops and cardinals, absolutely, frequent. And in the study of history, you'll see simony as one of the chief sins of the church, and that was the practice of buying political offices. I can buy my way in, or then once we get in, I can charge you guys for a prayer or for forgiveness or for a baptism or, you know, charge you for whatever. You'll see an instance, one of the more notorious cases. You had guys, literally, when you think, you go back to, you know, movies that have the little traveling medicine men, you know, salesmen with their wagon, and, you know, they're out there convincing people that they need to buy this, that it's the cure-all and the heal-all. They would do some of the exact same things selling indulgences, the traveling indulgence salesmen. What were a couple of the phrases they would use? That's the one I was thinking of, yeah. A coin in the coffer rings, a soul from purgatory springs. You could contribute to the church and save your dear deceased family member, however many years in purgatory they had to spend, and get them, you know, pushed to the front of the line to get into heaven's gates. So St. Peter would move them. It's kind of like the fast pass at Disney World, if you just offer enough indulgences. This was, and as you can imagine, I mean, it's the same way today. Those of us that are fairly spiritual and fairly serious about our practice of faith, we see corruption within the church in places. We see where it's practiced poorly. We see immorality, usually whenever it's priests or ministers doing something wrong. They get plastered all over the news. Clear Lake Intermediate's playing Space Center, seventh grade boys basketball right now. Where was I? Oh, instead of those being the exceptions or the outliers, imagine if that kind of behavior was the dominant tendency of the church. And that's really what you find in the 15th century moving into the 16th century. And that's why you have leaders and you have splinter groups demanding reform, asking for change. The notes you have tonight, I think this first lecture we might have used last semester. We talked about John Wycliffe, I know, number two. These were the forerunners of the big revolt, Wycliffe and John Huss on the next page. If you look at the third page, it's marked page 155 in the corner. Where I wanted to start is the very bottom of that, Roman numeral number 3. It's going to outline three different types of reformation starting around 16th century. First of all, we have Catholic Reformation. These are the folks that feel like the Catholic Church, the system, the structure, popes and cardinals and bishops, a state church, all of that's fine. We just need to do reform from inside. We're not trying to break away from the Catholic Church. We're not trying to separate church and state. We just need to do some moral cleansing. We need to get the right people in the right places, and we need to do reform inside the Catholic Church. You see there, number one, the church as it stands has all the necessary ingredients of Christianity. Leave the structure untouched, but cleanse it. Emphasis on moral and administrative reforms, of course. You see different efforts. Some of them were episcopal. That's reform within the offices, the bishops specifically. Movements following great leaders. You see the Hussites there, John Huss being probably the best known. Monastic movements. Most of the better known monastic movements were attempts to reform the church by moving out and separating and getting away from some of the corruption. And then conciliar movements. I know we talked about that also last semester. Get all the churches together in a council, put our heads together, try and come up with reforms that need to be made. One example, I mean, with the councils, they would get in the same room and say, oh, yes, we need to stop this practice of buying offices in the church. But 90% of the people in the room got their office how? Buying their office inside the church. And 90% of them stood to gain profit by selling positions underneath them, and they could get in a room and say, oh yes, we really need to do this, but there wasn't much teeth to the conciliar reforms because the people that were making up the councils were part of the problem more than they were really attempting to be part of the solution. So Catholic reforms. Here in a moment we're going to look at Erasmus and probably one of the more well-known reformers. We don't think of Erasmus as a reformer because he tried to operate within the structure and administration of Catholicism. He was operating the same time as Martin Luther and John Calvin. We know those names a lot better because they were part of the next category. They were breaking away from Catholicism. But Erasmus is a good example of the Catholic reform. A second one we refer to as magisterial reform. Magisterial being, we still want Her Majesty or His Majesty. We still want the state involved. We're not going so far as to say we want to break church and state. But the Roman Catholic Church as it stands is beyond repair. We need to break out and start anew. They would say we need to go back. You see, number one, we need to go back to the church before the ascendancy of the Roman Curia, before the papacy. The first 500 years, that was good. We need to go back before we had one figure in, I don't know if they were in the Vatican yet. Were they in Vatican yet? They probably were. Not they were, had been in Avignon, and now they're back in Vatican. We need to go back before we had popes and use that 5th century, 6th century church model for today. This is significant because the third example, the radical reformers would say, no, we need to go back even further before Constantine in the 4th century wed the Christian church with the Roman Empire and made a church and state symbiotic relationship. The magisterial reformers were not willing to break that. They still felt like whether it was the King of England, whether it was the Emperor of Germany or France or Spain, that we still wanted to keep that relationship in place. We don't feel like the church needs to be completely separate, but you see number two, the structure needs to change, doctrines need to change. And so these reforms were put forward by guys like Martin Luther, John Calvin, Ulrich Zwingli, the names that are most heavily associated with Protestant Reformation. You see, number three, the consensus was to recreate the church of the early fathers. Magisterial reformers. We're going to go back to Augustine. We're going to go back to early church fathers. The radical reformers are going to say, no, we need to recreate the church of who? We need to recreate the church of the apostles, not the church of the early church fathers. The church was still to remain a state church, a national church with the magistrate initiating and supporting reform and committing himself to the defense of the church. It's good in theory, right? We have power structures in place. If we have our governmental leaders on our side, we'd like to keep them on our side. We get state money, government money. We get lots of perks. They have lots of power. It's nice in theory. The problem is, part of the problem with the church prior to the Reformation was involvement of the state. That the state's priorities, the state's concerns, always trumped whatever was right, whatever was good, whatever was necessary in the church. And the church was almost always a tool. It was a political tool. You read more even about Luther and Calvin's efforts. The church still operated like a tool. They would find themselves, in fact, at one of the later meetings, they were trying to get a lot of the reformers together on the same page. And Martin Luther would not bridge the gap. Is this the Augsburg, perhaps? Augsburg Confessions. No, it's not the Augsburg Confessions. It's one of the diets. 13 out of 14 points everybody could agree on. The 14th point, which was the essence of communion, they couldn't agree on. Martin Luther would not go so far as to compromise with a symbolic view of communion, and his reason had nothing to do with theology. It had everything to do with the fact that in Germany, the Lutheran reformers were not yet willing to completely break ties with Catholic Germans. If we compromise with you Anabaptists that believe communion is symbolic, if we compromise with Ulrich Zwingli, who believes communion is symbolic, then our Catholic Germans that we're still trying to build bridges with are going to abandon us and leave. And so even in that instance, Martin Luther makes a decision based on politics instead of based on what he believed was best for the church, theologically. And he was not a symbolic view, but he was willing to compromise. But then he realized, you know, who we're going to be cutting off, and he reversed course. So magisterial reform was another track, and that was really initially was the most prevalent one, the most well-known one. C, radical reformation. Only the primitive apostolic church provides the true model. We need to reform the church to the apostolic state, hence to a pre-Constantinian type, which is not a state church. This probably resonates with us because we live in a place where church and state are separate, and we value that immensely. And lots of places around the world, that religion and government are still wed, sometimes overtly and sometimes much more covertly. But this was a pretty radical position to take in 1500s. Very radical. You see, number three, reform was all of the above. We just need to throw the whole thing out. We need to reform morals, administration, theological ideas, ecclesiological ideas. That's who the church is and should be. But the emphasis was on primitiveness, voluntarism, and separation of church and state. When we think about exemplars of the radical Reformation, there are a number of them. Some we would empathize with, and some we would see as much more radical than we would be comfortable with today. These particular notes you see that identify three types of radical reform. One is biblical Reformation. That stands very much with Baptists today, and you see one of the examples there, Anabaptists and later English Baptists. Those would be forerunners of what the Baptist Church is today. And their primary position was the Bible is the ultimate authority for reconstructing the primitive church. Reason and illumination are good, but they are subject to the Bible's objective authority. The Bible is our authority. Tradition, important, but not more authoritative than the Bible. Government, we need to follow it as citizens, but not authoritative in matters of religion. This was a radical position. Yeah, Walt. Nice hat, by the way.
Was there any challenge to the Bible, the set of books in the Bible at that same time?
No, the canon was pretty much set. Yeah. The canon was set. You know, I get asked this question often, and I go look it up often. I can never remember when the apocryphal books were added into the Catholic canon. I think it was long before this.
It was at the Council of Trent.
Council of Trent.
Yeah.
600s?
No, Council of Trent was 500s? In 1400s.
Oh, 1400s.
Yeah, 1400s. So. The Apocrypha gets added in. Of course, it depends on what vein you're in. I mean, they had the Pseudepigrapha in Eastern Orthodox churches. They had the Apocrypha in Western churches. Luther recognized the Apocrypha-ish with his stuff.
Yeah. He mentioned Luther. Luther was kind of a practitioner of a canon within the canon. In other words, there were books in the New Testament that he liked and books he didn't like. And the books that he didn't like, he just didn't mess with. He didn't refer to. James he didn't like. Revelation he didn't like. He claimed not to know what to do with it. And so I don't know there was a large argument about what books were in, but as people are taking different theological positions, even as we do today, they would pick their favorite books because these books prop up my position more than maybe another one might. Yeah. At this time, we're not there yet, but do you know the answer? You know the answer. Yeah. Yeah, these are the days of the Spanish Inquisition. As we start having reformers and people trying to break away from the Roman Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church responds in lots of ways and in different parts of Europe in different ways. But one of them was to root out heretics by any means necessary. And we'll give them an opportunity to recant. But if they don't, then we're going to punish them mercilessly here, thereby hopefully saving their souls from eternal damnation. Was the theological idea. So Spanish Inquisition is taking place at this time. Radical Reformation was of a biblical sort, also of a rationalistic sort. Human reason is the preeminent authority. Number two, nothing in Scripture should violate human reason. Therefore, this approach challenges traditional Orthodox doctrines such as the Trinity, vicarious atonement, etc. Anything that's supernatural that we can't explain, human reason is preeminent. And then, the next page you see a third category, the spiritualistic reforms. We had one that says the Bible is the preeminent, one that says human reason is preeminent. This one says the revelation of the Holy Spirit is preeminent. New revelations came to God's prophets, which augment or even supersede Scripture. This was 500 years ago. It's interesting. We've progressed a long ways, but in some regard, you can see strains of Christianity today where people have each of these three factors at the top of the totem pole for them, right? In a lot of charismatic Christianity, we like the Bible, we study the Bible, but going to school is not that important. Maintaining a certain system of theology is not that important. Standing in the line of any denominational tradition, not that important. What is most important is whatever the Holy Spirit speaks to me, that way I can speak to you and the Spirit can move us. They wouldn't say that the Bible is unimportant, that reason is unimportant. It's just Holy Spirit is preeminent. In the academy, in a lot of academic Christianity, you find this. The Bible, we want to study the Bible, we believe the Bible, but in some of its more supernatural components, we're going to need to, you know, cater our theology a little bit to push that to the edges or to explain it rationally, because human reason is preeminent. In the early 1900s, a New Testament scholar named Rudolf Bultmann was one of the biggest proponents of this kind of methodology. It's referred to as demythologization in biblical studies. And Bultmann was a great scholar, a believer in God, a faithful man, a good churchman. But he believed that the Bible had a lot of antiquated or more ancient mythologizing by primitive peoples, and it was the job of the modern rational mind and modern rational Christian to push that stuff out and bring these biblical stories back to a scientific place. And so you still have that in a lot of degrees in some much more liberal churches and also a lot of academia. And you have, of course, those traditions within Christianity that would say the church tradition is preeminent. They would take the Roman Catholic position. If the Bible says it, it's great, but if the Pope says it, that's even better. If it's part of our tradition and we've done it for a long time, then that carries as much weight as anything. And then you have the strain within modern Christianity where the Bible is preeminent. And we may not always agree on our interpretations. This tradition may think one thing about it, this one may think another, this one may think another, but we really seek to make the Bible preeminent apart from reason, apart from tradition, apart from spiritual, illumination or whatever the case may be. Ultimately, I think this is part of where, some of the big spiritual formation movement of our day is trying to educate people, is to say, look, all of these are important components of our holistic faith. Our tradition is important. That's why we take church, that's why we're studying church history, is not only to know what we've done, but why we've done it. And, the spiritual connectedness to God is very important. Human reason. We believe God gave us minds, and we need to use them in order to understand our world, in order to do our best to understand God through the many ways of revelation He's made accessible to us. And we believe that all of these are important. And probably in most of those movements, all those people would say, yes, these are all important. It's just which one rises to the top. And when push comes to shove, and we can't agree, and we're not sure, if any two of these four contradict one another, which one are we going to follow? If the Bible may seem to contradict something we've done traditionally as a church, this is where Luther would come into play. We've traditionally believed in, that the Mass is a perpetual sacrifice of Jesus and that communion is the same. And he would go to the Bible and say, I don't see this in the Bible. This doesn't seem to be biblically correct. Well, now we have a place where the Bible and church tradition don't agree. So which one rises to the top? And for the Catholic Church of that era, we know the answer. That's what made Luther a reformer, was he came in and said, you know what, I think that if our traditions and our way of doing it, even if it's 1,000 years old, doesn't line up with the Bible, well, I'm going to push the Bible to the top, and I'm going to choose to follow that. Remember, the Bible was not heavily prevalent. I mean, people didn't have a lot of access to it. The common man didn't have access to it. And we saw Erasmus is going to be well educated in Greek. He's going to work on translations, a Latin translation of the Bible, compiling a Greek New Testament. Martin Luther would translate the Bible into German, making it accessible to lots and lots of people. The invention of the printing press means we can get them, made more cost affordably and make them accessible to people other than just priests and bishops and cardinals. And so as people gain more and more access to the Bible, then all of a sudden, the Bible in certain pockets starts moving up the totem pole a little bit, and in some people's cases even moves all the way to the top. It seems, for a lot of us, it seems really natural, but these were big, major reform kinds of movements in the 16th century. I'm sorry. Questions or comments? When you think of Protestant Reformation, it wasn't just Protestants. Catholics saw a need for Reformation as well and were operating inside the church. You had Protestants trying to do a state church, and then you had fringe groups saying that we should just scrap the whole thing and start all over. Let's go back to Acts and follow their example to a T. On the page numbers on these notes, you actually go backwards, but on the next page, which you can't see the number, the reason I gave you these three pages is because of letter F. Desiderius, did I say that correctly? Desiderius. Erasmus, born in Gouda near Rotterdam, Holland, and I looked it up. I wondered if that was the same town where the cheese is from, and it is. The cheese actually came out of Gouda long before Erasmus did. You'll notice his dates. I think that's important because his time of schooling and influence as a scholar is going to be right around 1500, right around the time Martin Luther, Ulrich Zwingli are being born. And so he's going to be more of the aged grandfather scholar whenever Luther's theology and writings are all hitting the fan. And Erasmus, who'd been calling for reform since before Martin Luther enters the scene, agrees in some sense, but does not want to go so far as to break from the Roman Catholic Church. And that's part of the reason why. He was very much in favor of reform. He was very much a scholar translating the New Testament. You'll see some of his writings. They're listed on the next page. Under number 4, small letter B. Number 2, small letter C. Did y'all follow that? Just look for the underlined stuff. He produced Enchiridion Militis Christiani, which was a handbook for Christian piety. And then if you go down two more from that, he wrote a document called Moriae Encomium on the praise of folly, in which the whole writing was an allegory ridiculing the folly and corruption within the Catholic Church. So he ultimately, because he was a satirist of sorts about the foolishness of operations within the Catholic Church, he's kind of creating this It was, in his mind, it wasn't disrespect. He was satirizing what was going on, but he begins kind of creating this culture of making it permissible to question the church. And that is, while he would not want to break away from the Catholic Church, his attitude in calling out these things and making fun of them would kind of start a cultural shift in the minds of people. All of a sudden, the church is not, you know, held up so high. I compare it to what's taken place in the United States with the office of the president. 30 years ago, the president, whether you agreed or disagreed, held a position of respect in the country, and people would speak respectfully and respectfully agree, respectfully disagree. As people in the media have gotten more and more acerbic and bold in not only disagreeing but name calling and making fun of and just flat out insulting the president. The president's still a very important position, but it's not. It's not whitewashed anymore, and people don't have, as a culture, we don't always have the same level of respect for the office that we used to have. I don't talk politics in these kinds of environments, so take that for what it's worth. Erasmus created the avalanche moving downhill where the Roman Catholic Church was not this bastion of righteousness. We can call it for what it is, and that paved the way for change. Later on, when Luther enters the picture, the next page over. Yes.
So earlier you were talking about how people had bought these offices and they're the only ones in these councils going, yeah, we should change. Oh, yeah. I know we should promote women too. Yeah, okay, we're never really going to do that, right? Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, the question is, as much as people have talked about these things for a long time, what are the catalysts that actually start change happening? And next week, we're alluding to Martin Luther tonight. Next week, it's going to be all Martin Luther all the time, and maybe some John Calvin as well. But the interesting thing about all of these guys is it's almost like when you go to the first century Roman Empire and talk about Jesus being born into this world at a time where language and relative stability, safety, travel, the cultural, political, military environment was perfect for that to happen. That's the exact same thing that takes place here with the Protestant Reformation. As we saw, guys like John Wycliffe and John Huss 100 years earlier had some of these same ideas. The stuff going on in the world at the time didn't make it accessible or easy for them to push their thoughts into reality. We're going to move into, as we get into the 16th century, you're going to have emperors and kings that don't like these movements, but they're facing the Turks coming through Constantinople, turning it into Istanbul, marching on Vienna. There's a political threat, and so they can't afford their countries fragmenting over religious ideologies. They're willing to give it more time in order to keep their country together to fight wars. And so more time means more freedom, and more freedom means we can push some of these things into practice, whereas otherwise we would be branded a heretic and drawn and quartered and put to death before a chance for anything to happen would take place. You want to answer that question any other way?
It was a confluence of events.
Yeah.
I will talk a little bit more about it. The single greatest event that led to the Reformation was not the 95 Theses, but the creation of the Gutenberg printing press, because it changed fundamentally how we get information. So it was the democratization of power that begins happening.
Well, and you think about it. I mean, he mentioned the 95 Theses that Martin Luther is going to write, but the printing press not only made available eventually more copies of the Bible, but it made it a whole lot easier for someone like Martin Luther to distribute their ideas much more widely. That back page on Erasmus, you'll see C, the critical edition of the Greek New Testament, 1516. That's considered his most important work. Variety of other things that he worked on. You see his influence at the bottom. He was the most renowned scholar of his age. was opposed to metaphysical speculation. He was a reasoning guy. God's given us brains, we ought to use them. We ought to try and think our way through this. And he helped pave the way for Reformation with his satire, but was unwilling to break away from the Catholic Church. So that is Erasmus. The next page, I've jumped a couple of lectures that concern Martin Luther, and as I already told you, we'll cover that next week. It's a much longer conversation, and so I didn't want to try and get into him tonight. While Martin Luther is coming up with taking his own path towards Reformation ideas in Germany, in neighboring Switzerland, another reformer named Ulrich Zwingli was taking his own path to some of the same end results. Of the three big reformers that we typically tag to this time period, Zwingli's the least known of the three because he doesn't have a denomination or a systematic theology named after him. We continue to know Martin Luther because of the Lutheran Church. We typically continue to know John Calvin because of Calvinist theology. But Ulrich Zwingli was the pre-runner to John Calvin. Really, if we trace Reformed theology and the Reformed Church back to its roots are here. They're in Switzerland, and they're with Ulrich Zwingli. Modern-day Presbyterianism would probably find its roots here as well. Zwingli, you see, was born in 1484. He was a German-Swiss, hence the name. See more of his, and we're not going to go, it's a lengthy set of notes. I'd direct you to the book. His chapter, I believe, is chapter 5, and you can kind of read it in a more narrative form there. But I wanted to point out some of the highlights and things for you to look for. Was appointed as a priest at an early age. During this time period, I mean, when you think about European history, Germany is a big kingdom, France is a big kingdom, Spain, of course, we know, Ferdinand and Isabella are sending Columbus all over the world, and they're setting up colonies in the Americas. Italy, of course, is still heavily influenced by the church and by the Pope. And Switzerland is just kind of in the middle. It's not that it was, ironically enough, it wasn't neutral then like it is now, but they were mercenaries back then. We'll go fight wars for whoever will pay us to go fight wars. And so that created a unique environment for the church leadership once they began, you know, wrestling with how we should respond to the call from Charles V of Germany or Francis I of France, I suppose, right? Where's Francis I, King of France? Yes. Who was King of Spain at this time? Ferdinand and Isabella. My politics are not as good as my church history, political history. So Switzerland was a country of mercenaries, basically. Page 178, you see early reform at the bottom. Jump to page 179. Zwingli, by the way, was a scholar. I sympathize much more with Zwingli than I do Luther. Okay, Luther's history was a really rough childhood, really harsh parents, a very emotional and tumultuous journey through faith and going through monasticism and priesthood and, you know, always feeling guilty. And what Luther did was he interpreted God through his relationship with his father. And his father was a very strict disciplinarian, impossible to please. And for the longest time, his impression of God was, I have to be good enough. I have to be good enough. I have to be perfect. God's never going to forgive me. I can never escape hell. And ultimately, his journey was much more emotional than Zwingli. Zwingli was a scholar. He went to school. He read the Bible. The Bible was available to him. He studied Greek. And he believed that the Bible is important. We can study it and know about God. And if it contradicts the church, then the Bible needs to take precedent. Reason was a very important role for him in the Reformation. This is going to be different from Martin Luther. You think why Martin Luther, his predestinarian views that say, I'm so sinful, I'm incapable of searching for God, I'm incapable of asking God to forgive me, I'm incapable of coming to God on my own. A lot of that was based on his personal journey, his experience with his dad, his inability to abandon some sinful habits in his life. Zwingli, on the other hand, was, man, he just went to school, studied, read the Bible, and came to some of these. And ironically enough, the two guys really didn't know about each other early on. Two different countries, two different leaders, but they were both moving in this direction of recognizing that what the Bible has to say doesn't always line up with the practices being implemented in the church today, and making, influencing others around them, building up little communities of reform-minded people, and kind of moving the ball down the road. It's, again, it's like Wycliffe and Huss. It's not that Martin Luther was the only one. Martin Luther is just a commonly known guy who exemplified dissatisfaction with what was going on, and there were lots of others like him, including Erasmus, including Calvin, including other names that we'll get to in the next few weeks. Page 179, the Diet of Worms was occurring in April 1521. That's a Luther event. We'll talk about that next week. The Diet is like an assembly. I had to go look this up, the etymology of the word as well. It's from a Latin word, which means dieta. It means a parliamentary assembly or daily food allowance. So our word diet, we just use the latter much more commonly in our English than the former. But it's an assembly. Garrett and I were talking about it earlier. When I think about the apostolic councils of the 400s, 500s, there's going to be a series of these diets in the Reformation era. They were more regional, more local, and the purposes of the apostolic councils were usually church leaders all getting together, bishops, cardinals getting together to try and iron out what's heresy and what's not, what's going to be our orthodox theology and what's not. These diets usually involve some political leaders, a king or an emperor, and it was usually, the purpose was to get together and find out why Martin Luther is a heretic so we can get rid of him, or find out why somebody else is a heretic so we can get rid of them, or, as it may be, find out why they're not a heretic so we can all get on the same page and fight this war. The series of diets in Martin Luther's biography are comedic almost, because in this diet he's branded a heretic, and in the next diet they say, oh, no, he's not. And this one they say he's not, and then the next one they say, oh, he is. And then the next one he's not. I mean, he was a heretic on and off again, a handful of times, because political matters influence the decisions often. So the Diet of Worms was taking place at this time. Zwingli still was hoping for reform from within the church. Rome's desire to not have a schism. Rome didn't want to break because they needed Swiss mercenaries. This gave Zwingli a lot of rope to do a lot of things, question a lot of things, challenge a lot of things. And the Roman Catholic Church might not have liked it, but they weren't going to come down hard on him because we need your help when wartime comes. Zwingli's area of influence was Zurich. So that's kind of, not only is it in Switzerland, that's, the hub of the country. In 1522, you asked about some of these catalytic events, and like Garrett mentioned, there are a handful of them. In 1522, there's this incident called the Affair of the Sausages. That would make a great movie, wouldn't it? Basically, Zwingli had preached that certain practices of the Catholic Church were not rooted in Scripture, and one of them that he called out was the Lenten fast. And so, a Zurich printer wished to reward his workers for overtime work in producing Paul's epistles during Lent, and he had this big party, and instead of giving them a very meager Lenten fast-worthy meal of fish, he had a big party, and they had sausages. A lot of people partook, including two priests. Zwingli himself did not. But this was one of those moments where we're not just saying, yeah, this the Bible doesn't say this, but we're taking action based on something that's very non-traditional, but following the Bible instead. After that, number two on the next page, Zwingli sent a petition to Bishop Hugo. I believe he was Bishop of Constance, which was the bishopric that Zurich fell under, regarding celibacy. He says, you know what, the Bible doesn't say anything about priests or monks or nuns or anybody having to be celibate if they're serving the church. And so he was requesting that if priests or, you know, anybody in leadership wanted to marry, that they be able to do so. It didn't go well originally, but later on, you see under C, many priests, including Zwingli, had common law wives or concubines but were not married. Here, they openly admitted the problem and attributed blame to the Catholic Church, not themselves, for the duplicity of the church, and just called it out and said, this is not biblical, so why are we doing it? Again, in Zwingli's case, what differentiated him from Wycliffe or Huss was time for his ideas to disseminate, freedom to put some of them in practice and for other people to follow, whereas 100 years earlier, he probably would have been executed promptly. The military situation of the day, we need your mercenaries, and so we're not gonna cause a ruckus in the capital of your country, gives him freedom to push some of these, you know, into practice. You see a couple of his works there, number three. Starting number five, minor disputations. Disputations would be little debates that would come up. The next page, 181, the first disputation. The Bishop of Constance was invited to a debate, and at the debate, Zwingli presented all of his positions and gave biblical reason for his case. And the representative of the Bishop of Constance refused to answer any of them. He said, I will return and we'll confer, and the bishop will give a response at a later date. Well, what does that look like? Zwingli wins. I mean, he won the debate, at least in the general populace, the people that were present to hear it. And it gave him a lot of credibility. His influence and popularity continued to grow. The Augsburg Confession is, we'll talk about that a little bit more with Luther. This included a variety of reformers gathering together and basically saying what it meant to be a Protestant, what theological reforms they were calling for, doctrinal reforms they were calling for. You see under D, the Augsburg Confession articles were denouncing purgatory, the office of the Pope, the priestly garments being mandatory, the priesthood itself, clerical celibacy, the traditional mass. And 500 years later, I mean, all of those six things, all still very much identifiable within Catholicism, and you get outside Catholicism in any evangelical or Protestant denomination, and you don't see any of those. I mean, this was the Augsburg Confession was a marked break in declaring, these are the problems we have with Catholic practice that are not biblical, and we're breaking from those. So Zwingli, from a theological point of view, let's see if there's anything else I wanted to really mention. We get into Anabaptists, and we'll return to Anabaptists and their conflict with Zwingli in a couple of weeks. Page 184-85 is where Zwingli ultimately died. Through his reforms, eventually what happened was the Swiss government allowed their different regions to identify themselves, whether they wanted to stay Catholic or whether they wanted to follow a Reformation position. And before, it was very peaceable. The different, I think they called them cantons, what we might call counties, fought with one another. And Ulrich Zwingli was killed, and he was wounded in a battle where Catholic cantons were marching on Protestant cantons and trying to take over their cities. The area where Zwingli was located, the reformers were not prepared for battle. It was a surprise attack. He went out with a few to try and stall and give people in his area a chance to to, you know, collect themselves and get ready to fight, was wounded in battle, was found wounded on the battlefield by one of the Catholic military leaders and was put to death. After he was killed, he was quartered and his body was burned by the Catholics. Of course, not very much longer, they reached a situation of peace and said each canton can decide whether they want to be Catholic or Protestant. Yeah, that whole, you know, cutting Zwingli's body into quarters and burning him, we're really sorry about that, but oh well. Talk about Spanish Inquisition, it wasn't just in Spain that things like that were done, because we believe we have heresies, you know, running rampant throughout our church populace. Theologically speaking, Zwingli is important for us. I mean, he was a Bible-first kind of guy. He felt the Scriptures were important, and we stand in that tradition. He did go so far as to say, if it's not in the Bible, we shouldn't do it. And so he was a renowned violinist, but because the violin or the organ are not mentioned in the Bible, we don't have them in church. That should also sound familiar to you. That's kind of a forerunner of, if any of you have or know people in the Church of Christ tradition, this idea that if it's not, it wasn't just if it's contra the Bible, then we should challenge it. He would say if it's not in the Bible, then we shouldn't put it into our worship. He was in favor of simple worship services, because he felt like anything that could distract you from the Word of God should not be a part of our service. And so he didn't just pull the organ out of worship. He took music out of worship completely. Worship was the Bible. It's the Word. It's the reading. It's the preaching. It's the Word. And that's what you need to encounter. And so while we appreciate part of the path Zwingli went down, we might not go quite so far as he did with some of those other exclusions. Yeah. Yeah. And for him, there's a lot of reading about Zwingli in that he followed some Neoplatonistic philosophy in the material and the spiritual, and you're going to see Martin Luther is not so anti-material. I embrace Luther in this, and that the material world helps me experience God. Great music, art, a good dinner, you know, company of friends. I mean, I experience God in part through the material. Zwingli's philosophy was that the material is contra the spiritual, and when it comes time for you to encounter God, you need to put the material completely to the side and entirely focus on the spiritual. The material is a distraction. So it was a philosophical point of view that I wouldn't share, but that we, you know, we do perhaps see still present in some regards. Even today, one of the other big challenge that we mentioned is, what does communion mean? And so, for the Catholic Church, communion is in the taking of the Lord's Supper, the elements actually transform into the body and the blood of Christ. The theological term we give to that is transubstantiation. The substances transform. Martin Luther is going. He's not going to be too comfortable with that. But he's still quasi-Catholic. You know, in the communion, it's still very important. The presence of Christ is very much with you when you take communion. It doesn't turn into the body and blood, but the presence of Christ, he would use language like it is in and with and behind and around. The presence of Christ is everywhere when you take communion. And so Luther's, the later theological term we would give to Luther's position is consubstantiation, the prefix con meaning with, that the presence of Christ is with the substances when you take them. Zwingli is going to represent the symbolic view. Luther wasn't comfortable going all the way down the path of symbolic. Zwingli looks at it and says, what really matters is what's taking place. He was a spiritualist. What really matters is what's in the heart of the individual taking it, not so much the what's going on with the elements and the substances as they're being taken. And so we stand in Zwingli's shadow as Baptists by being symbolicists when it comes to communion. Interestingly enough, Zwingli went that far with communion but wouldn't go that far with baptism. And for that, we have to get to the Anabaptists to see. We connect with Zwingli on communion, but we'll have to connect with Anabaptists when it comes to baptism, at least in the Baptist tradition. Not all of you come from a Baptist tradition, and so you see how all the moving parts are beginning to spin off a little bit. It's, we want to reform from the Catholic Church. Maybe we want to break away from the Catholic Church, but it's not a matter for many of these reformers, it's not a matter of if, but it's a matter of how far. How far are we willing to go? And for some, they would go just a little bit, and then their tradition would take root there. Lutheranism is much closer to Catholicism than the Baptist tradition is. Luther would break away a little bit. The Anabaptists, the radical reformers, are going to break away a little bit. They're going to break away a little bit further, and then their group's going to set up camp. Everybody kind of breaks away from the Catholic Church, and they set up camp at different places, and then they begin developing their own traditions at that point that will continue to linger on even until today. So the Reformation is upon us. 16th century, 1500s. It's happening in Switzerland. It will be happening in Germany next week with Martin Luther. The Catholic Church is responding by persecutions, executions, hunting out heretics. It happened everywhere. Of course, in Spain, it was most prevalent with the Inquisition taking place there. The Reformation has started. And so we will look at Martin Luther and John Calvin next week. We're pretty close, man. That's it. Okay. Thank you guys for coming.